You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
And welcome to Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I want to thank I-1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. Pints of Politics presented by New England College, and this hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. I am Chris Ryan. Great to be here at the Barley House, and we're going to welcome in the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, just a little bit. Certainly no shortage of things to discuss with the governor since the last time we spoke. Obviously, President Trump referring to New Hampshire as a drug-infested den. We'll get the thoughts of the governor on that. And also, you know, how you strike a balance between making sure that individuals are aware of the nature of the challenge, but while also kind of putting it in the right proportionality. We'll talk about that with the governor in just a little bit here on the program. Also coming up, but we'll discuss President Trump and his seeming unwillingness to denounce white supremacists, Nazis, and the KKK in regards to the incidents down in Charlottesville, Virginia. In clear terms, Governor Sununu denounced what took place. The president was unwilling and remains unwilling to do so. And certainly, you know, I think the governor's trying to create some distance between himself and the president, but also doesn't really want to comment on and criticize every little thing that the president does. So there's a balance that he is trying to strike, and we'll see, you know, his thoughts on the president's seeming lack of clearness in wanting to and truly denouncing the individuals responsible for the racist and disgraceful behavior in Charlottesville, Virginia. There's also a lot of things going on here in the state of New Hampshire. Some positive public polling came out for the governor, and also how individuals are feeling about the direction for the state. We'll talk with him about that as well. Coming up in just a little bit here at Pints and Politics at the Barley House with New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. I'm Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. Again, this hour of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and this segment of the program presented by New England College. We'll come back with the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now. I was a butcher. You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I want to be I-1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program Pints of Politics presented by New England College. This hour of the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health, as we're honored to be joined on the program by the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, with us here at the Barley House. And certainly no shortage of things to discuss both here in New Hampshire and across the
Always
country.
Something going on here, Chris. Always something.
As the governor joins us here at the Barley House. And, you know, we'll start off with some of the national news, and obviously what took place in Charlottesville, Virginia, to me was one of the saddest moments I've seen in American history in recent years. And whenever you see, you know, the rise of the Klan, neo-Nazis, it's beyond white supremacy, it's beyond sad. And I thought your remarks were strong and kind of where, you know, it needed to be, and because the potential obviously exists for these types of rallies to take place in New Hampshire.
Unfortunately, just the idea that culture, that mindset is out there at all is, to your point, it's sad, first and foremost. You think, boy, it's 2017. Are we really having this discussion
right
now? And unfortunately, you know, what we saw in Charlottesville, we shouldn't think is only stuck in Charlottesville. Most of those folks were not from Virginia.
Right.
So you have to talk about it in strong terms. You know, when you talk about these white supremacists, the Nazi stuff, it's ugly. The only way to really push back on it is en masse. We all have to have the ability, the courage, and the willingness to stand up, to talk clearly that is not going to be tolerated, that is not the America of today. It's a shame that it was part of America ever,
right?
And so, you know, I think when we all stand up, we all talk with one strong voice, we let people know that it's not going to be tolerated, surely not here in New Hampshire, not in Charlottesville, and it shouldn't be tolerated anywhere in this country.
Now, I certainly understand that, you know, it's a dangerous game for you to have to respond to everything the president does and doesn't do and so forth. But, you know, in the context of what you were saying, it seems like, you know, the president wasn't on board with you. He wasn't on board with Marco Rubio. He wasn't on board with John McCain. He wasn't on board with Ted Cruz in condemning this in the strongest possible terms. He's been asked over and over again to condemn all white supremacists. And what does that say to you, and does that bother you?
Look, the president is always being criticized for either talking too harshly here or not harsh enough there. Communications is not this administration's strong point. Let's just cut right to the chase there. With me, it's more about what are we going to do tomorrow? What are we doing going forward? Right? What actions are we going to take? Are we going to condemn this today and just hope it doesn't rear its ugly head? Or are we going to stay active and be a voice and actually make sure that we're promoting constructive conversation, positive conversations, conversations that make sure that everyone is included, and that's really going to be the culture and society that we drive forward on. So I try not to get involved in the political wrangling around the semantics of points. Could he have talked harsher? Well, of course he could have, but the point is, what are we all doing tomorrow to make sure that this is something we don't have to deal with in the future?
You mentioned that communications is likely not the strong point of this White House so far. What danger, in your view, does that, you know, present for America on the world stage, whether it's, you know, North Korea, whether it's not acting harsh enough in regards to white supremacists? Is the lack of communication and coordination out of the White House concerning to you, whether it's on not just these types of significant issues, but also in an agenda that you'd like to see pushed forth on infrastructure, on making sure that the appropriate funds do arrive for the opioid
crisis? Action is everything for me. I mean, it really is. I try to be a governor of action. I believe anyone in a leadership position has to be of action. When I look at this administration, who they've put into certain positions, whether it's Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, and Wilbur Ross over at Commerce, and Perdue at Agriculture, these are great people that have done great things, great managers, know how to get things done very quickly, know how to break through bureaucracies. That's what I feel very hopeful with the administration, and why we continue to work with them so positively, and you know, why we're going to keep working into making sure, whether you talk about the opioid crisis, it isn't just here's my letter, give us more money.
Right.
It has to be more than that. It has to be, here's the formula you need to use. Here's where the previous administrations have made mistakes in the past, where New Hampshire has been left out or on the curb in the past. We're not going to let that happen. So we're going to continue to work with this administration in a positive way, because he has people on his team that really know how to get things done.
It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. You created distance in between where the president was, and referring to New Hampshire as a drug-infested den, and the actuality of where we are as a state. And granted, you know, these remarks were private remarks in a conversation with the president of Mexico, but it kind of plays to that mantra that politicians will say one thing to your face and tell you you're the most beautiful state in the world, and you love your people and so forth, and then it's a drug-infested den in a private conversation. So I think that was why that was, you know, significant. Have you heard at all from the White House or from the president following your condemnation of his statement?
Not directly on my comments. I mean, we talked to the White House constantly, frankly, on a variety of different issues. So we have talked to them. When it comes to those comments, he was wrong. The president was wrong in his comment. You cannot cast such a broad negative brush over a state that has the fastest growing economy in the Northeast in the past 6 months, in a state where we've actually seen some real appreciable difference in overdoses and deaths coming down a little bit in certain areas. So nothing we're going to claim a victory on. No one should ever be trying to claim victory on an opioid crisis. But we have seen some results here. We've doubled our alcohol fund. We provided more flexibility to get treatment and recovery open in certain areas. We're rebuilding our entire prevention programs in our schools. We've taken more aggressive steps than any administration in history in New Hampshire in terms of dealing with this crisis. And we're seeing some headway there. So with that, you got to push back. You never want anyone casting such a blanket negative aspersion on a state that is doing just so darn well. I think our schools were ranked top five in the country recently. We're doing some incredible things. Still a lot of untapped potential, I believe. Driving more business, driving more business-friendly climate, finding more workforce to come in, you know, making sure that our healthcare system is viable for the long term, making sure that we're creating real flexibility in a true market where it didn't exist before. Just managing, right? You got to manage, and when you do, good things can come. So so that was the general message that we put back on the White House with, and one that I think most people would agree with.
I think there's a fine line between how you address the opioid crisis in taking it head on and making sure that individuals know how significant it is, but while also kind of, you know, libeling a state, so to speak, where if you, and I, you know, you look at some of how we've dealt with it in the media as well. WMUR calls it the state of addiction. I don't know if that's necessarily the best thing for the state of New Hampshire from any perspective.
I agree.
How do you go about, you know, balancing those two, where you want to have a true and accurate picture, as you mentioned, regards to economic development and where the state currently is, and so, but you also want to draw attention to the fact that this is a really significant issue with families in our state. Everyone has a story of someone they know that's been directly affected, kids, families, and so forth. How do you balance the two?
I think it's really clear. I think what we have to remind everyone is you have the fastest growing economy. You have a state that's breaking down rules and regulations, driving more business, has the highest quality of life in the country, has the some of the best schools in the country. We have it all in spite of the crisis that we have. Why? Because we're putting resources where they need to be on the drug crisis. We're getting results. We can be nimble because we're small, because we don't get tied up in too much bureaucracy here. We can be nimble. So if we're trying something innovative and it works, we can keep doing it. If we're trying something innovative and it doesn't work, we can pull back very quickly. So the biggest bang for your dollar in any part of the country where you're trying to address the opioid crisis, it's right here in New Hampshire. And we again, we're one of the first states into the crisis, and I firmly believe we'll be one of the first states out because we're being innovative, because we're pushing the envelope, we're trying new things, and we're getting some results.
If you look at the public polling data, which has come out recently from ARG and UNH, there is a stark difference between how the president and his administration is viewed and how you and your administration are viewed, with numbers, you know, in the...
To the positive. Let's be clear.
Well, I was getting there. Give me a little time here. We got to fill this whole hour. There's a stark difference between the two, obviously, with the president's numbers being, shall we say, not great, and yours very good. And also a different view of where we're headed as a country and where we're headed as a state, which I thought were the most significant numbers in that UNH poll, is that people were really optimistic about the direction that the state was headed in as a whole. And obviously you're the leader of the state, and so it's a part of that. But as a whole, everyone was very optimistic. Why do you think there's that difference in the view of Granite Staters about where their country is headed, where their president is headed, and where their governor and their state is headed?
It really comes back to live free or die. I really believe that. That isn't just a few words on the license plate. People hear me say it all the time. It's how we live, which means we're community-driven. We look at each other. We look at the folks that we elect as individuals, not just on a party line or not just on a general platform. We really look at the substance of the person, what they're truly doing to affect positive impacts in our communities, and we make our decisions based on that. And because of that, because, again, we just have fundamentally such a different structure from the rest of the country, when you want to do good things, really, you know, good things can really come of it very, very quickly. And we just have a very smart elected electorate here, a very smart constituency. They stay involved in these issues. They make decisions for themselves. They understand what's going on in their community. So, you know, when they don't necessarily just cast blanket aspersions on one group or the other, they make their decision. If they're not thrilled with what's happening in Washington, look, I'm not thrilled with what's happening in Washington. I'm waiting for Congress to do something, right? When is the congressional delegation going to get up and put real constructive solutions on the table to be part of healthcare, or real constructive solutions on the table to work with the administration and get things done for the country? If the entire Democrat delegation in Washington, whether from New Hampshire or otherwise, if their only message for the next 2 years is, well, we're not going to do anything Trump wants, well, that's not what you were sent there to do. You were sent there to be part of a solution. Right. Stop telling us what you can't do. Impress us with what you can do. That has to be the mentality. I think we have that mentality in the State House, Republican and Democrat alike. I think we work well together. And we disagree on issues, but we have a lot of mutual personal respect for each other. Our folks that I will, you know, hammer on politically and on policy, that doesn't mean we don't respect each other. It doesn't mean we can't sit down and have good conversations. And because of that mentality, that attitude in the state, I think the people in the state see it. And frankly, I think we're just being an example for the folks in Washington, maybe something that they can learn from.
And I think it has a lot to do with partisanship in Washington as well, whether it's how Democrats handled the Affordable Care Act the first time around or how Republicans tried to handle it this time around, where Democrats, I think, would have been liked to have been part of a process, but it was not set up so they could do so. And hopefully there'll be real health care reform that'll come out of this going through appropriate subcommittee and having hearings and so forth in a fashion that is more recognizable. But if you look at the construct of, you know, Congress, or particularly the U.S. Senate at this point in time, the only way that health care was ever going to pass, in my view, was in a bipartisan fashion. Because if you just want to pass it along party lines with a 52-48 majority, whatever you do to get Rand Paul and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz is going to siphon off, you know, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and John McCain. So if Congress were, and we've said this so many times before, if Congress were to act more like New Hampshire and focus things on a bipartisan fashion, then I think that we'd be better off. But on health care, what would you like to see on a bipartisan type health care plan?
Well, bipartisanship to start with, right? The fact that healthcare is purely a political construct at this point is bad. That is not a good thing. It has to. You have to create a system that is simply going to work best for the constituents and the consumers. The fact that we keep talking, we're getting all tied up, and it's an important part, but we're getting all tied up talking about the insurance plan.
So
where
so
are we
right.
going to talk about the cost?
You're so right.
The cost of the Tylenol, the cost of the liver transplant, right? The cost of the care.
Yeah.
That is driving a lot of this. And because the insurance plan has gotten so political and costs have gotten so forgotten, it is no longer a free market.
Yep.
There's no free market here.
Yep.
So when I'm talking to Anthem and Harvard Pilgrim trying to make sure that they can stay into our New Hampshire healthcare exchange, there's no free market. It's a moving political target that they're trying to hit. And that challenge is incredibly difficult, which is why they have left so many other states' healthcare exchanges. Now, we fought very hard. We've pushed to make sure that they have flexibility in their rates. We've pushed to make sure that they can do certain things to stay. Is it going to cost consumers 45% increases because Obamacare has failed? Absolutely. That is, and that's not sustainable in the long run. We've bridged the gap, but it is still up to Congress in Washington to find the long-term solution for us. The answer, what we have advocated for very clearly, very specifically, flexibility to the states, true block grant power to the states. The federal government should not be in the business of managing extended health care plans. Mm-hmm. That is not what government was designed for. Push it back to the states and let each state design their systems to meet the needs of their constituents. You'll be able to do it much more efficiently. I mean, you could probably even take less money and still meet far and away all the constituencies that you want to meet with all the care and coverages you want and all the flexibility in those plans that your people actually want. So by creating more of a free market system, pushing it back down onto the states, and allowing us as governors and legislatures, the true representatives of the people of this country, we'll create our own free market system, both within the states and then competition amongst the states, which again drives down cost. This is all economics 101, but we're letting politics drive the message down in Washington, and that's just not a solution for anything.
One of the most exciting things, in my view, about having Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House and leading this process was that I was hopeful there was going to be a plan very similar to what you just described there. Because let's face it, if you look at a state like New Hampshire, the exchange only covers about 5% of individuals who are covered by insurance, and another 5% of Medicaid expansion, from what I understand.
And about 10% total, that's right.
Total, yeah. So, I mean, you're still leaving a tremendous amount of individuals outside of that. And certainly there's an effect, the cause and effect that has to do with what happens in the exchange and that 5% and the employer-based plans. But you're not even addressing all of the insurance company aspect of things, let alone the cost. So it's really just kind of a pin drop in the whole healthcare system, despite the fact that it's referred to as being a comprehensive healthcare reform. So I assume that you went to the president and his team and advocated for this plan. It's a plan that, in my view, could have passed the House and the Senate. I mean, John McCain.
Even Democrat governors would love this idea, right?
John Hickenlooper.
Hickenlooper would love it in Colorado.
So what? Why did Congress not go along with a plan that the U.S. Senate and Mitch McConnell go along with a plan that could pass? I think John McCain would have.
It was a mistake.
Yeah.
It was a mistake. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. So they came to the governors and they asked us for our advice. We gave some very specific examples. I think more concrete and specific examples than any other group in the country gave. They just didn't take them the first time around. They didn't take them the second time around, which is why I came out against the Senate's plan. And I said, this is not going to work for New Hampshire, right? And that's not easy to come out and do that, but it was the right thing to do to make sure they understood it. I'm hopeful that now that there are two or three shots at this have been gone down in flames. I'm working with Scott Walker. He's taken a real lead on this in the country. Matt Bevin, the governor of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas. Myself, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. Larry Hogan in Maryland. A few governors have really gotten together and said, okay, let's design something that really works. Now, it isn't just give us the funding, call it a day.
Right.
We might all have to take a little less funding. That's a possibility. like I said, if you give us the ability to design our own system, we can probably get as many, if not even more, people covered if we so chose, because we're going to design plans that meet our constituents' needs. And Wisconsin will design one for their needs, and California will design one for their needs. Let every state create the system that's most efficient for themselves. Why Congress chose not to do that, I can't say. I've spoken with John McCain. I've spoken with Lindsey Graham. I've spoken with a lot of the folks that have led the charge on this. I think our message is pretty clear from the governors what we're looking for. We're working now trying to put together our next round of ideas and again, hope that with some of their losses here, that they'll take it up as and maybe take what we're proposing as the backbone and structure for the next round of health care reform.
It's Pints of Politics here at the Brawley House. That is New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. This hour of the program presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and Pints of Politics is presented by New England College. When we return, we'll talk about the budget, full-day kindergarten, and also check in on a couple other important issues. I think infrastructure funding, I liked what the governor did in regards to returning funds to the local communities to fund the project that they thought were most significant, and also talk regulatory reform as well here on Pints of Politics at the Brawley House.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Here's the road I'm on. It's blacktop and gravel. It's a faded blue line. This road I It's a big man sleeping on a dead man's switch. And I'm a roadie, faster than a locomotive, tougher than the edge of the Rockies, hotter than a smoking gun, ragged as the road I'm on.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Brawley House. I want to thank I-1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. And before we get to some of the significant issues from the last session and also some important issues moving forward, I want to talk to you about an executive order that you signed earlier today regarding emergency licensing for Manchester VA physicians. Obviously, you know, we talked about this last time. We had a conversation at the Hampshire Motor Speedway. It just broke. And you were looking at how you could address this issue in a substantive fashion. How did you decide to do it?
Well, you know, obviously we had an issue at the Manchester VA. Secretary Shulkin, we got him very involved, and to his credit, he got very involved right away, within hours, making changes up there, bringing teams up. He sat down, listened to the whistleblowers himself personally, has really gotten very directly involved, and that's good management right there. But now it's about taking the next step. So one idea is to, with the construction and the damage that was happened during the flood, well, we have to have the ability to not just say, well, we can't serve you, but keep people in the community, in the Manchester community specifically, and allow those services be handled by other hospitals. Catholic Medical has stepped up, offered to do that with VA doctors, which is great, but we realized there was a kind of a hitch in it. A lot of the VA doctors, they're federally regulated, mm-hmm. which means they don't all necessarily have a specific New Hampshire license to practice medicine here in New mm-hmm. Hampshire. They have it somewhere, but not necessarily in the state. That's just the way the VA works. So I signed an executive order earlier today that basically exempts them from that, at least on a temporary basis, to allow those procedures to take place so we don't slow down the quality of care. You have a private organization like Catholic Medical stepping up, being part of the solution. That's the way we do it in New Hampshire. I cannot thank Alex Walker, who runs Catholic Medical, and his team enough for being part of that, but the state has to get involved too, and making sure that there's that continuum of care, that there's not an interruption of service, and the VA can keep doing what they do.
What has been your assessment of how the federal delegation has dealt with this issue? Annie Custer had a hearing regarding this, and she sits on the Veterans Affairs Committee, obviously in the House. What has been your assessment of particularly the two senators, Shaheen and Hassan, and how they've dealt with it?
Look, I think that congressional delegation as a whole has to do more, step up, put constructive solutions on the table. If you're talking about the VA, what are we going to do with choice? Choice 2.0, making sure we get the bureaucracy out of that system, as opposed to only driving people into a centralized VA system. Give folks the choice and the ability to go and have flexibility in the private sector and get the bureaucracy out of it so they're much more apt to take advantage of those opportunities. That's all part of the congressional discussion. You know, general health care, right? Show me any constructive constructive ideas that have been put forth. Right. When we asked the senator, both senators, you know, what are their constructive ideas on healthcare? They said they're going to sit down and talk about it and hold hearings. And we've been talking about it. Where are they? Where are they? We're sitting there putting up ideas. I've been writing letters to the president and the congressional delegation down in Washington for months with real ideas on the table, and we haven't seen anything out of them. So they have to be part of the solution. Otherwise, it will stay. These issues will stay political, right? It is up to them to make sure that we break down the politics of not getting anything done in Washington, D.C. It's incumbent on all 100 senators and every single congressperson down there. So that's my message to everybody. It isn't just our delegation. It's every single one of them. Do your job. Do your job. We're doing it in New Hampshire. We're getting results up here. We're doing things strictly on what's going to get the best results for the people of the state, and people are responding to it. But Washington, they have to step up, take a page out of our book, and start acting a little more like New Hampshire.
Yeah, my assessment would be that if it's a base issue for our two senators, they are going to have hearing after hearing and town hall meeting after town hall meeting in regards to it. But this is a significant issue for veterans in our state, and it's been years and years and years that we have had deficient veteran services in this state, in my view. We've talked about this for every single campaign, it seems like, as long as I've been covering campaigns. Why don't we have a full-service VA, and why is it?
Look, the biggest veterans crisis we faced was under the Obama administration, right? The biggest health care crisis we're facing now is because of Obamacare. You cannot bury your head in the sand and pretend like it's not happening and just leave it up to the Republicans just to fix everything. You've got to be part of the constructive solution there. That's all I'm asking. And I'm sure that there's some good ideas out there. I'm sure they're hearing some good ideas, but they got to bring them to the table. They got to be part of that. The people want them to be part of that constructive solution. Throw politics aside, whether you're talking about the veterans, healthcare, education, just get it done for the people.
We talked so much about the budget throughout the process, but now that we're a couple of months away from that process, or at least a month and a half away from that process coming to conclusion, coming to its conclusion, I'm wondering your takeaways as you're starting to see some of the implementation of aspects of your budget.
Well, we're starting to see it already, which is great in terms of some of the funding that we've put into place. We put a lot of money towards mental health, for example. People know I've called it the kind of unspoken crisis mm-hmm. over the past 2 or 3 years. Well, we're not going to let that happen anymore. We have RFPs and requests for proposals out there with the dollars that we've allocated for more community action groups so people can get mental health services in their community, for more beds in certain areas so we can get people out of the emergency rooms, sitting in the hallways, just waiting for care. It's quasi-inhumane, frankly. So we've really put a group together, a bipartisan group, to put real solutions on the table for mental health. Kindergarten, obviously, the first aspect of Keno are being discussed now because Keno did get attached to it. Nothing that I was a huge fan of, but it got it done.
Right.
This is something that no governor even really proposed before, never mind got done. But it's going to have a great impact for cities and towns across the state to have that equal opportunity that we talk about. Just because you live in one town, your child shouldn't be denied an educational opportunity that the kid across the border.
Just one thing on the implementation of Keno. How is this all going to work based upon the fact that we're going to see, obviously, towns like Concord and Franklin and Nashua have begun the process, vote upon whether or not Keno is going to take place. And then places like the Barley House are going to make a determination if it's best for their business to have mm-hmm. Keno in there, if in fact it is approved. And then we'll see how many people play after that. What are the provisions that are in place to make sure that there is actually, appropriate funding for kindergarten that comes from Keno?
Well, the free market. I believe by that, because everyone has a choice. Towns have a choice. Individual establishments have a choice. Everyone has a choice. If it's working, if the path that your town chooses is a path that works for you, then it'll continue, and that's just fine. If you want to make a change, then make the change. As a constituent, as a voter, we're still letting, again, we've allowed it to happen at the state level, but the individual communities have to step up and make it happen. What we're already hearing is most everyone is going to take advantage of this. And mm-hmm. some towns that don't, they can choose not to. That's fine for them if that's what they choose to do. We have to respect that. But again, at the end of the day, I think that the market's going to take over, and it's all about providing equal opportunity. Why should one child have an opportunity in a town the other doesn't? For those towns who say no, they're going to have to explain why they're denying those opportunities.
Right, but let's say the people don't want to play Keno to the levels that the revenue estimates indicate. Then what?
There is a baseline. There's a baseline of 80% funding here, and it only goes up from there. I think the projections are extremely conservative, frankly. Okay. So I'm not going to really worry about that until that kind of horrible situation would present itself. But even if it did, we still have a minimum baseline funding of 80%, which, again, I think most every town in the state will take advantage of.
Infrastructure here in the state of New Hampshire, I was a big fan of, in any way possible, returning money to the local communities to make their decisions about what they're going to do in regards to road projects. Because I think the entire process, if we've covered very closely what happened, with Main Street here and the applying for the Tiger Grant and the funding and, state funding for Loudoun Road, and you have to meet certain specifications. To me, the best that state government or the federal government can do is allow for money in a free and an open fashion, transparent fashion, to flow to local communities to make the best decision possible with that money and appropriate it. And so what led to your determination to do that with the infrastructure fund?
Well, look, it was common sense, right? If we had, we decided early on with Senate President Morse, if we had additional tax dollars that went unspent through fiscal year 17, traditionally, other administrations would create new programs with it, right? We said the best dollars to be spent are back in the local cities and towns. Cities and towns, specifically as it comes to infrastructure, roads and bridges, those roads and bridges that you and I are traveling over and everyone is traveling over every day. Let's turn it back to those towns, provide some taxpayer flexibility, maybe even, look, if towns chose to have these dollars replace other dollars and return money to taxpayers, that would be fine too. But it's all about getting the money back to the taxpayers, back to local control, and putting it to these roads and bridges. And that's just the New Hampshire way. And I it shocked me that other governors hadn't done that before. And I hope that we have a robust economy and we're conservative on our revenue estimates and we get to do it again.
Back to the you're supposed to keep talking just for a little bit there.
Oh, sorry. While you're taking your drink, I was putting you in the awkward position. So $30 million, yeah. Though, right? $30 million back to cities and towns, and every single city and town gets their appropriate share. So they don't even have to, fight it out or anything. They simply show up. The town of Salem woke up the other morning, and we handed them a check for $550,000. Londonderry, the same thing, just over $500,000.
I think Concord was close to $800,000.
Concord, yeah. $800,000. I'm guessing Manchester has to be well over, well over $1 million, mm-hmm. or whatever. It is. So that's real money we're returning right back to the cities and towns, right back into taxpayers' pockets, so they can best control the destiny in their local communities.
Back to the opioid crisis here for a second. We discussed it earlier in regards to the president's comments, but after the president initially had a opioid discussion from his golf club in Bedminster, he really focused, it seemed, in that particular discussion mostly on just the law enforcement piece. And as we know, that's one piece of really four that needs to be focused on. And he did not at that point declare it an emergency. He subsequently has. But what does that mean in terms of funding? And I've talked about, I think there needs to be an infrastructure put in place across the country where there's a website, where there's significant dollars put into umbrelling out services so that people know where to go. I think one of the problems currently is for-pay, for-profit entities have kind of the loudest voice in the community in regards to treatment, and a lot of times that's not affordable for the middle-class family. And I think there needs to be the loudest voice should be, whether it's a state program or a federal program, that an individual, when they've hit rock bottom, whether it's overdosing, whether it's being arrested, they are ready for treatment, they're ready to change their lives at that point. But I still don't think that person knows what the number is they call, what the website is they go to. And to me, that would be a tremendous federal program.
Couple things there. First, let's start with the enforcement side. We put a couple million dollars extra into the enforcement side because, while we all know you cannot arrest your way out of this, you do have to hold drug dealers accountable. Mm-hmm. You cannot start giving them the shortened sentences and just take it for granted that you're only going to deal with this with treatment and recovery. You need prevention programs on the front end. You need enforcement on the back end. And I'm saying this as a dad with a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old and a 4-year-old. I know they're going to be offered these drugs by somebody. I know they're going to be offered these pills. You have to go hard on the dealers, absolutely, and hold them accountable. Make them think twice before they come up here to New Hampshire. On the idea of access, you're 100% right. We have our 211 number that we have here in New Hampshire. It's gotten out there. I think it does pretty darn well. But making sure that portal is easy, accessible, and knowing who to call and what to do in the case of either yourself or a loved one needing help, because that first step is the hardest foreign. So let's make it the easiest
for them
to take. A nationalized version of that, I don't know if that's the right answer, because I'm just against nationalizing almost anything other than the military. And, in the state, I can tell you we can probably do a little bit better. Our 211 does okay, but we can probably put some resources there and make sure that we're just getting the campaigns out, the messaging out.
The problem is, as you mentioned, I don't like federal programs either, but the unfortunate part is that's where the resources are. And if there's going to be significant resources that are dedicated, obviously the optimal situation would be the president declares a state of emergency and flows money into the state, and then New Hampshire can make the decision as to what.
Well, my
to do
message
with it.
to the White House is pretty clear. We spend our dollars better with better results than almost any other state when it comes to the opioid crisis. We're seeing some positive results now. If he's looking to put in billions and billions of dollars, we have to make sure we get our appropriate share, a share that's proportionate to the size of our problem, not just proportionate to our per capita. And if he does want to, try a program like that, well, what better place to land it right here in New Hampshire? We'll manage it ourselves for the rest of the country. Because frankly, we'll do it better than everybody else.
Final thing on regulatory reform and also creating a enhanced entrepreneurial environment in the state, and obviously the two kind of walk side by side a lot of the time. And to me, New Hampshire has always been a state. I mean, you look at the professional people in business, in academia, and you'll find a lot of individuals who moved here from other places. And to me, that's going to be a big part of New Hampshire's future, and bringing in that 30 to 40-year-old who may have had a job on Wall Street or in Boston. They don't like it anymore. They don't like living there, and they want to come up here. They want to work for themselves. They want to start a business or work for an entity that allows for them to work from home. So two things. Reforming the regulatory system here in New Hampshire, what do you see as being the biggest hurdles for business activity? And the second part is, what can the state do in municipalities and towns in order to create an environment where it is as easy as possible for somebody who has a specific skill to start a small business? Because as there's a lot of different aspects of running a small business that don't necessarily come to the forefront when you're sitting at the bar and you're like, and I'm going to do this.
Taking the idea, you have to go from idea to revenue as quickly as possible, and let individuals, when you create an atmosphere for them to do that, they'll flock here because this is the place to do it. And you got to promote that. So we've talked about the 1600 rules and regulations that we wiped off the books last month. That was a great start. We're creating a steering committee to go after another kind of second round of rules and regulations that frankly just get in businesses' way. We've worked hard on our business taxes. We've broken down those barriers. We're out there promoting. We've just never promoted ourselves. We're working with Canada, our biggest trading partner to the north, making sure that we're creating an environment to bring not just businesses but also workforce. Dean Kamen and I, Dean just started ARMI, A-R-M-I, his big regenerative technology manufacturing institute in Manchester. And I said, now we got to go get workforce. So Dean and I will be going to the universities together. Mm-hmm. In person, not just talking about it, sending press releases about it. Nobody cares about that. You got to get down there and talk to the students coming out of school. Talk to the startup companies in Kendall Square. Start enticing them over here so they know what we have to offer. Most people don't come here in terms of workforce or business simply because they don't know all the benefits that we have. So by promoting it, you can really create an atmosphere and get kind of the word out there that this is the place to land your company. This is the place to grow your family and to bring workforce in. And I'm a big believer that when you put all the skills and assets that we have in this state together, the rest of New England, the rest of the Northeast is going to be playing catch up with us for a long time.
So two cool things. One, you raced a school bus. Which was it, an actual school bus, or was it like a revved up school bus?
No, it was an actual school bus.
So how fast you were able to get that?
I topped out. I did the quarter mile. I topped out at 72 miles an hour, I believe.
You were able to get up to 72.
Believe it or not,
See, that's the thing is, I think you could probably get the school bus up to 70 miles, but it'll take
about
2 miles.
17, 20 seconds, something like that. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, I won the first race, and it was all to promote the lottery education, what we're doing, and then I raced the Teacher of the Year. Tate Aldrich is our Teacher of the Year this year. He was in the other bus. He was in the slightly faster bus in the second race, and he took home the trophy. But that was a lot of fun. And again, you got to promote. It's all about promotion and getting out there and talking about these great things that we have to offer.
So now you're going to you're going to race Phil Scott?
I am, Governor Scott from Vermont. He is a professional race car driver. Let's remember that.
Are you going to race him in a race car? Or?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
We're working out the details now, to be honest.
Right.
So he told me he loves to race anything. So he races snowmobiles and race cars. He's a great governor doing a lot of great things in Vermont. We share a lot of the same issues. And so the opportunity, again, to bring some raise some awareness for some charitable entities or whatever it might be and race maybe here in New Hampshire or even over at Thunder Road or wherever it might be in Vermont. We're still working out the details, but it should be fun.
In White Park here in Concord, there's going to be an old school rec day, which is taking place on Wednesday with all sorts of cool things, including tug of war, which I would challenge you to, but I'm not sure you want to see the optics of me, you know, beating you that bad in tug of war.
Tug of war? Boy, well, I got to tell you, I have not been involved in a tug of war since November 2016. And I won that one pretty good.
But you're not going against
Collins
this time.
I've been training for my 5Ks, but I haven't been benching lately. So maybe give me a little time to work on my buys and tries and whatever else, my glutes. I don't know.
All right. That's always good to see you. That's New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu here on Pints of Politics here
at
the Barley House. One of the 914-50 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. This hour of the program presented by Riverbend and that segment of the show presented by New England College. We'll come back and wrap things up after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Heart is a blue. Shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room. No space to rent in this town. You're out of luck. The reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I want to get on 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I'm Chris Ron. Appreciate joining us for the program. This hour of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and that segment of the program brought to you by New England College, who's the sponsor of Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. We just heard from the governor of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, who joined us here for a discussion on the issues across the country and here in the state. And I thought, you know, really interesting some of the things that the governor had to say, the direction that he is taking the state in, and how, you know, he has really been able to get strong footing here in New Hampshire amongst the electorate. And Dante Scala, my friend at UNH, really highlighted the fact that Sununu's popularity is, you know, inching close to John Lynch levels here in the Granite State. And of course, he has just been governor for a relatively short period of time. But I think that, as I talked about during the course of the campaign, you know, his energy, his excitement, his love for New Hampshire, his wanting to, you know, take the state in the right direction, I think that's really infectious with voters. And he's also, you know, great at the other aspects of being governor, you know, showing up at different events, racing in a monster truck, and, you know, the types of things that a New Hampshire governor does outside of swearing in judges and signing legislation and executive orders. And that has allowed for him to create distance between him and Donald Trump. Again, the numbers are shocking, and there's not really any connection being made by voters between Donald Trump and Chris Sununu, where Trump's numbers are terrible and Sununu's numbers are really good. And from a 2018 perspective, I think that is going to be a huge challenge for Democrats, is how do you bring the two together? And Sununu has been able to, as we talked about in the open with Trump's remarks in regards to Charlottesville, I mean, he has been able to find a good place to land politically in denouncing Trump and criticizing him, you know, criticizing his communications efforts, but also by, you know, not going after him too hard, as in to not, create an environment where he draws the ire of Trump his supporters, and so forth. Interesting conversation with Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire. I am Chris Ryan, and this is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, 1914-15, ConcordNewsRadio.com. Appreciate you joining us for the program, Pints and Politics, presented by New England College. And this hour, the program brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
25 years and my life is still trying to get up that great big hill of hope for a destination. I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man. For whatever that means, into a crisis.